From the ATX Hot Sauce Studio in Austin, Texas, it's the Jeff Ward Show.
Award-winning and all-natural, ATX Hot Sauce has the perfect sauce for you. Flavor first, heat second, and not just local, going national. Go to ATXHotSauce.com. All right, let's do some day drinking. We'll do that with a friend of this show, has been for some time, super popular. I believe the last time we had a conversation, it was a glorified glass bong. I could have doubled as a sex toy, but I don't want to start that way. I think that was our last appearance together, and it was fun. It was delicious. So let me set her up. It's Daniela D'Souza, who is a sommelier. I'll let her introduce herself, give you all the credentials, and then we'll launch into what to taste, what not to taste, how to drink, how to not drink, how to order. I'll let her take it from there. So, hi again. Introduce the world to yourself.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me back. My name is Daniela D'Souza. I live here in Austin, and I've been in the wine trade for about 15 years. I was raised on a vineyard, and currently I have a couple of jobs. I'm a wine educator, and so I have a level 4 in wines from the Wine and Spirit Education Trust, and I teach those levels at a wine school. So I run a wine school, and I also, my day job is selling premium Burgundy wines and other organic French wines directly to consumers and putting on a luxury event.
All right, so talk, Daniela, a little bit about regions so people can get some perspective there. Sort of regions for dummies, or however you want to phrase it.
Yeah, so there's a tremendous amount of regions, and I think we can start locally and kind of expand out, but we obviously are California-centric as the United States. I mean, I think we're the only country that is California-centric, because obviously it's in our backyard. We are very proud of California. I think people are really starting to get interested in the Willamette in Oregon and even Washington wines, that's very distinctive. Washington, if you really enjoy Cabernets and Merlots from California, I think that's a really great place to start to branch out in, because it's, to me, a lot less expensive and you get some really great quality. And then obviously there's all of Europe, which they don't normally label by the grape. They label by the subregion, which gets very worrisome and overwhelming for consumers. So, but I think that France is a great place to start. And the most famous wines in the world arguably come from France. And so you have so many subregions there. I could spend probably 20 hours on France alone. But then, you know, things like Chile and Argentina, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and the Southern Hemisphere, great bang for your buck. We're just kind of ignoring all those regions, I think. And they're delicious, and they make the same wines that we're accustomed to.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something we all run into, again, getting stuck in our ways. So you could find similar grapes, similar wines that you would get in Napa, and you'd pay, mm-hmm. I don't know how much less for a Chilean wine, or
oh my gosh, Chile or, especially.
Or a Spanish wine.
Yeah, I mean, Chile, Spain, great areas to go for value. If you're wanting, you know, to not pay Napa prices, which arguably some of the best vineyards in Napa cost anywhere between $500,000 to $1 million an acre. And guess who's paying for that price? It's you. I mean, you can't spend less than $100 in order to, for that company to make a profit. So looking elsewhere and supporting those economies it's going to be amazing for you and totally worth your while.
So is that a Google thing as well, where you start to find less popular regions? I mean, I know someone hears this and they're going to say, yeah, that sounds cool. But I don't know where to start for a Chilean wine. I don't know about a Washington Pinot. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think people get really brand loyal. Like they go, okay, I can go to that section, because whether you're going to a grocery store or a retail outlet, you go, they're labeled for you. That's the great thing. You can go to that region and go, okay, I'm here. And then you can find something that says Cabernet on it, but you're perhaps not familiar with the label or the producer. And therein lies the faith. How are you going to know whether you like something or don't like it unless you try it? And then I wish I had a snap way to figure that out, but it all comes down to you just being open.
What's the dumbest thing we do?
Oh, do I just pick one?
Okay, pick three to five.
Oh God, the dumbest thing I think, just off the top of my head.
I drink way too much. I mean, other than the obvious of getting hammered. But as consumers, as wine and champagne and spirits consumers, like if you said three, four, or five things, stop doing that, everyone.
Yeah, I have many of these. Okay. So the first thing I can think of is stop saying that you hate one variety. It drives me crazy. Like, I don't drink Chardonnay.
Oh, right.
Okay.
No.
But have you tried every single Chardonnay? And I think that that's such a problem that we have, is we've tried one example or even two from one region, and then we decide that we don't like the grape. I think that's such a shame, because it leaves out an entire world of possibility. And so my advice would also be, when you're trying these wines, that you don't discount an entire, you know, subset of grape or the entire region simply because you had one or even two or even three bad experiences. You might just be buying really crappy wine. Yeah. Which leads me to my second thing, which is,
if I say something to you, like, I have this absolute disdain because of the stereotype, you might as well get sweet tea if you're going to drink Chardonnay.
That's completely wrong. Because have you tasted Chablis from Burgundy?
Maybe just get like a Powerade and pour some sugar in it. There, that's how about that?
Yeah, but you're drinking bad Chardonnays. Like, you're drinking really crappy, cheap Chardonnays.
Is there any
that
good ones?
Aren't good. Yeah, I mean, in order to break, how about we break the Chardonnay stereotype once and for all? Because I sell Chardonnay for a living in the form of white Burgundy. So Burgundy, there's only two main grape varieties grown there. Chardonnay is white Burgundy, and Pinot Noir is red Burgundy. And so I go around the country and I present these white Burgundies to people, and they go, wow, I really like this. And I say, well, it's Chardonnay. And they go, oh, I don't really like Chardonnay, but I really like this. And I'm like, well, this is where Chardonnay was born. The grape Chardonnay actually came from the region of Burgundy, and it's not befuddled with oak and sugar and additives like the ones that maybe people are accustomed to. I think a great, just top tip really quickly, is, I know I told you that the French label by region. So go to the region of Chablis for Chardonnay, find Chablis. That is crisp. It is refreshing. It is very dry, and it doesn't have that over oaked sensation. It's closer to maybe the crispness of a Sauvignon Blanc than it is the butteriness and oakiness of a bulk California Chardonnay.
Yeah. That's that butter, that buttery flavor is just, yeah.
Yeah, but that's not in every Chardonnay. Pepper. That's the thing, is like, I hear this all the time. It's just not, it's just, like, I want
to, you know, punch me in the face.
Not quite.
Okay. All right. The second dumbest thing we do.
The second dumbest thing we do, I think, is blame all of our ailments on wine. Like, I think that we go, sulfites cause headaches and all of these things, which a lot of research is being done on this. So I won't completely discount this, but there's actually more sulfites in a few dried apricots than there is in an entire bottle of wine. And so if dried fruit or canned food or all these, like, sulfur is a preservative and it's in all sorts of foods. And we go, because it's the only thing on our wine label, we just blame it on all of our things. When I got to tell you, it's the rest of the crap that's in your wine that's causing a problem. And it's mainly, I mean, alcohol is an obvious thing, but it's also sugar and it's also essences. Like, you can literally open up a catalog and find papaya, passion fruit essence. And you can add that into some wines in some regions. I won't say all of them, because in a lot of places it's illegal, mainly higher end European regions. But like bulk wines, you can add whatever the F you want into right. these wines, and it's going to cause you to not feel good.
Okay. So read the labels for that stuff.
I think a good rule of thumb.
Just stay away from the bulk wines. Is that really what you want to say?
Yeah, but people don't realize that what they're drinking is bulk. They okay. think a lot of the wines that they're drinking are very good because they're not paying $10 for it. So let me say, without naming names, which I'll name names if you want to, but I don't want to piss anybody off. If you can find that bottle of wine in almost every retail outlet, in almost every restaurant, regardless of the price point, that wine is a bulk wine, and millions of cases have been made. And at that point, that wine is a manufactured product. It tastes the same year after year, which it shouldn't. Wines should taste different every year according to the weather. But if that wine tastes the same every single year, that is a manufactured wine, and it has sugar and it has additives.
And Okay. Is there a price point? I mean, I know this is all over the map too, and it's hard to put you in a spot of naming a price point. Is there a price point at which you can say, listen, $8 means it sucks, or $12 means it sucks? I mean, to me, a big science is fine. You know, if you have a price point, and I've found that, you know, no, $8 doesn't work, but 16 to 25 can work, and you can find really good wine 16 to 25. So, I mean, is there any logic based on fact, forget that, forget logic, based on fact that a price point means it sucks?
I think that's a really good question. I think that generally, if a wine costs less than, now with inflation, maybe $16, $17, $18, then you're probably not using amazing grapes. Now, there are exceptions. I'm talking about in the United States.
Yeah, right,
when you go to Europe, you're not paying all the taxes. Like, we mark everything up three times before it gets to the US. But in the US, there's a lot of bulk things below a $15 price point that probably are great on your wallet, but not maybe so great on your health.
Okay. Got it.
Make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. What, by the way, what is the time that it's produced or even picked or whatever the wine is actually produced? What is the markup by the time you get to buy the glass in a restaurant, in a good restaurant?
Yeah. Is it coming from the winery? Like, do you want every single markup, or do you want it?
I don't know. I mean, what if you could stand at the door at the winery and say, pour me a glass, what would it cost? And then when you show up at a restaurant somewhere and you say, pour me a glass, what does it cost?
Yeah. So in the United States, let's take a U.S. Winery, for instance, because it's a little bit easier. That winery is selling. We have what's in the U.S., not to be nerdy, it's called the three-tier system, wherein it's marked up probably three times before it hits you. So that wine is maybe being sold wholesale $10, let's just make this up, to a distributor. Then the distributor is going to sell that wine to a restaurant, and then that restaurant is going to sell that wine to you. Typically, if it's a buy the glass in the United States, the glass covers the entire cost of the wholesale bottle. So you're actually paying for one glass, you're paying for that entire bottle.
Okay.
So it's a 400% markup. It's a lot.
Is the markup on wine greater than, you know, another mixed drink or something?
Actually, the most margins can be found in the drinks program. I'm not super familiar with liquor markups because I've only worked behind the scenes in wine. But yeah, I mean, that's where they're making their most money. I think they're about equal.
Okay. This time of year, I guess, depending on where people live, any recommendations, suggestions? Since I'm not going to say another bad thing about Chardonnay the entire time that we're talking. So
I appreciate that.
Of course, because you'll make me feel terrible. Suggestions, experimentation with foods, without foods, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think that there's so many ways to go. I just went walking this morning and it's finally 60 degrees in the morning and I'm like so ready for red wine. You don't even know. I've been drinking white all summer and rosés because it's so hot.
Yeah.
So I think a really great transition wine while the elements, while, you know, you still get warm days and cooler nights, is to have maybe a lighter chillable red. I think that's a fun thing. And there's a couple of options for that. There's several options, in fact. Definitely Pinot Noir. I mean, again, I sell a lot of red Burgundy. So Pinot Noir, especially from Burgundy, is a really great choice. Put a bit of a chill on it. Amazing. And then Beaujolais. I think people get this really weird, especially like older generations. Beaujolais Nouveau was a big thing. And that's like this bright, unaged sort of bubblegummy wine that comes out the third Thursday of November every year. But I'm talking about higher end Beaujolais, which is closer to a Pinot Noir. So that would be a really cool, if you love Pinot, you might really enjoy higher end Beaujolais, which costs about the same.
Higher end as in, like, you could get a good bottle for what? Something good, not something
$25, okay. $30. Yeah. I mean, no more than 30, really. I mean, some of them go up to 35, 40 plus, but I think you can find great things for $25 or $30. Yeah.
When you say chilled and people hear red wine and chilled, they have no idea what you're talking about. Explain what really is chilled. What should it be and why it's important and that people don't get it. These warm glass, you know, a red wine in a warm glass makes my face hurt.
I think that would be a great tie-in to what people do that drives me crazy, especially in restaurants and at home. Everybody is drinking their red wine too warm. It is disgusting and it annoys, especially in Texas, where I go outside and my wine is already at 90 degrees. It goes to the ambient temperature. It's disgusting. I don't want to drink it. So a really great way to combat that is put it in the fridge and chill it down. Typically, red wine, especially light-bodied red wine, is supposed to be consumed at around 55 degrees. And there are wine thermometers that you can buy. You can stick them around. They're not that expensive, and you can check. Or you have a wine fridge, and you can control that. And then that wine is coming out, and it's the correct temperature. You're bringing everything back down in balance, and it doesn't feel so warm and gross.
Yeah. Oh, no. The right temperature for whites is what then?
It depends on the white. I would say like a fuller bodied white, like something like a full bodied Chardonnay would be, around 50 degrees. But then cooler wines, I mean, you can put them down to like 45 to 50. And then as they warm up in the glass, you can kind of experiment and go, okay, it's really smelling very good. Because the problem with chilling your wine down to the fridge level, which is just above freezing, is the fact that when you pop it open, you can't really smell anything. It dampens down the aromas. So it's a really great idea to let your wine warm up just a little bit before you drink it.
Now, when somebody hears you say, and it's true, the warm red is gross. What do they do? They're sitting at a restaurant or bar, it's poured, and it's not chilled.
Yeah, so I've gotten really good at not feeling guilty when I ask for things from restaurants because people simply don't know. And if they think I'm the crazy one, then so be it, because I feel very confident and proud in how much I know. So what I do is I unapologetically ask for an ice bucket. And people think I'm crazy. And I say, hey, listen, this is too warm. It's really hot outside, or it's really warm in this restaurant. I would really love an ice bucket. I'm going to pour my wine back in the actual bottle, and I'm going to stick it in the ice bucket. And for right now, I'd like a cocktail, or I'd like some water, or I'd like a beer or something to start off, a white. And then I'm going to wait for this to chill.
Wow. Is it trashy to get a chilled beer mug? If the wine is poured and it's too warm, you pour the wine into the chilled beer mug and then pour it back into your wine glass. What do you think of that?
That's not a bad idea.
Thanks.
I've never tried that before, yeah. But you do whatever you need to do. I think if you want to drink your wine with ice cubes, you're entitled to do that. You know, like I don't personally recommend it because it's going to water down the wine, but wine is all about pleasure to me. So you do whatever you want to do. And that could be a cool idea.
It's just something I've done. I mean, instead of going, you know, if you're uncomfortable, not as assertive as you, I mean, you're an expert, so you can get away with it. But I just say, hey, can I get a chilled beer mug? And they have no idea why. And then I wait till somebody walks away and I pour them back and forth. And there you go.
That's a cool idea. I might try that next time.
Thanks. Because people aren't comfortable. I mean, that's the thing is, you know this, people are intimidated by the whole setup.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it takes some experience to appreciate, man, that is a warm glass. And like you said, it doesn't matter how good the wine is. When it's red and it's warm, it sucks.
Yes.
It's ruined.
Completely,
I mean, I don't care if you pay $10 or $50 for it. It's ruined.
I had like a $2,000 bottle on Sunday.
What?
I tried one. I didn't order it. It wasn't mine. It was brought, whatever. It was definitely over $1,000, let's say. And I was drinking it outside. And very quickly, my little taste of it warmed up to 90 degrees, or it was 98 that day. And I'm drinking it and I'm going, this is such a shame. This is not how that, you know, not what was intended for this wine to be consumed at. And I really think it definitely ruins the whole experience. So if you're paying a lot, which restaurants will mark up your wine, it's going to be at least $30 starting out, going up to the thousands. Like, get it the way that you want it. That is very important, and never be shy. People might go, what is she talking about? But who cares? You're the one paying, and you're tipping, by the way.
Yeah.
You need to get what you want.
If we pour a $2,000 bottle, this is with you, the pro, you know what's coming. $2,000 bottle, because I actually had a chance to be a part of an experiment like this. There's a $2,000 bottle, there's a $500, there's $100, and there's $25. Could you get them all right, price-wise?
Are they the same variety?
Jeez.
I know. Yeah, sorry, I have follow-up questions because I'm annoying. But
you know what I'm saying? I mean, can somebody tell? I know what everyone thinks. God, $2,000 bottle of wine. I mean, how great must it be?
It depends, because there are $2,000 bottles that aren't that good. And then there are $500 bottles that are better. You know, so it really just does depend. And I think that people, consumers, they put on these YouTube videos and they love to be like, I can't tell the difference and this isn't worth it and blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, because number one, you have an untrained palate, no offense. And number two, you know, you might have a different preference than somebody else. So like, I think wine is like art. I think you and I have different palates and what we like. So I might be able to tell and you might not, and vice versa. So I think you should only spend $2,000 or $500 if you can appreciate it and if you have the means.
Yeah, I love that. I love that line. Wine is like art. I mean, I tell people that. Just experiment. Find out what you like. Okay, yeah. Two things. Pairings with food. One, how much of that is BS? No, actually, three things. And then what garbage is fed to consumers? You just said YouTube videos with a bunch of goofballs out there. I mean, people are over what quick hacks that they think they're getting good information. It's garbage. And then talk about openers.
Well, you've given me a lot of stuff. So let's break this down. Wine and food pairings. Are they you know, real thing? Is that a real thing,
a
good
thing?
Wine and food pairing? 100% it is. Oh. And that comes down to biology. We have certain taste receptacles that actually can, if you adjust them by eating, and you can, your wine will actually taste better. That is a scientific fact. And I can give you an example if you'd like.
Sure.
We eat wine, or we drink wine with typically cheese and meat, right? Like a charcuterie board is the most common thing that we are consuming. And people don't really think about why. You know, like they just take it for granted that it's going to be served, and that's maybe, you know, cheese and meat tastes good. Well, in addition to tasting good, cheese and meat have three things in them. They have fat, they have salt, and they have protein. And all of that actually clogs tannin receptors and acid receptors on your palate. And it makes, and tannin is that mouth drying sensation, by the way. And then acid is that pucker that you get that might not be so pleasant, but it's clogging those receptors. So when you go back to the wine actually seems smoother and richer.
So the higher the tannins, the better it's going to be if I eat and if I'm having cheese and meat. Is that the correlation?
Yeah, well, I think that the tannins, great thing
tannins
is
means drier, right?
Yeah, that gravelly sensation with red wines only.
I think of chalk, but okay.
Yeah, perfect. Okay. Yeah, so I think that you can, if you're drinking a very high tannin wine on its own, you might not like it. You might go, I don't want to sip on this by itself. Then you add food, you could add a steak, you could add anything with protein, fat, salt, all of those things, and that wine is going to taste better. So you can take wines that you previously wouldn't have enjoyed and combine them with food, and they will taste, as I said, you know, richer.
So the rule that people have heard probably forever about whites with this, reds with this, is that BS, or is there some good science there?
I think that it's not BS, because I think there are some exceptions to that rule. But in reality, what you need to do is pair the weight of the food with the weight of the wine. I think what people fail to take into account is what sauces are on the fish or the meat and how that is prepared. So a steamed fish is going to be different than a fish that's slathered with a crawfish cream sauce and things like that, that's heavier. Like, I wouldn't pair the same wines with those. I would pair, like, that crawfish sauce is going to be heavier and maybe a little bit richer. I might even go, especially if it's super flavorful, with like a Pinot Noir, even a lighter Pinot, and break that mold. Versus that steamed fish, I'm going to go really light-bodied white. That makes sense?
Yeah, no, it does. That's really good advice. It's a good practical piece of advice. So this is going to sound depressing, but I guess that's the way I drink. So drinking wine without food, would it be better? I mean, should I, someone like me who's just in the corner reading or something, would it be better if with something, or is it just fine without?
I always think that wine is better with food. Okay. I think a really great rule of thumb is to have maybe experiment with pairings. I think that if you're not paying attention to the wine and not paying attention to the food and zoning out in front of the TV, or you have a book or something else is capturing your attention, you should probably just drink. And that's probably your wind down time and your method of relaxing.
Yeah.
But if you are out socializing, or if you are paying attention and really curious, then I think it's a great time to bring in some food and experiment, because you might find something that you really love.
Desserts, chocolates, all that stuff. Is that a taste killer?
With wine? Yes, which leads me to another thing that I hate when people do.
Okay, do it.
Which is ask me to put on like wine and chocolate pairings during Valentine's Day. It is my worst nightmare. I avoid it at all costs.
People seek you out, hopefully not perverted dudes, and then they say, hey, Daniela, wine and chocolate. I don't eat sweets very much at all ever, but I think all I can think of is chocolate just ruins everything.
So I put on like luxury events, like wine events for a living. So that's, there's no surprise when everybody loves a seasonal event.
Okay.
And so when February comes along, they go, okay, well, what do you think about this? I go, okay, I will do it, but it's going to not be the same as you think it's going to be, because red wine, every red wine does not go with chocolate necessarily. There's a very specific red wine and a very specific chocolate that you can pair, and that is it. Because sugar is the thing that's going to damage all dry wines. It's going to make wines taste bitter and bad. So go with a chocolate that's very, very low in sugar, i.e. dark chocolate with a very high cacao content, with a very like full-bodied, rich red wine. That's what you need to do.
Right.
Or go with something like a port. But people don't like hearing, oh, you need to drink a sweet wine with sweet chocolate. They think they don't like that as much. But that's the only way you're not going to damage your wine.
Maybe it's just Valentine's Day and they want to get drunk.
There's that too.
Sorry. I mean, but as a general rule, once you go to dessert or once you go to sweets, reds and whites are, forget it. It's off the table.
I would go to sweet dessert wines. Okay. And it's a category that people go, I don't drink dessert wines or I don't drink sweet wines. And that's another big mistake. I mean, I talked to you about people discounting all varieties and going, I hate those. Saying that you hate all dessert wines, like, I feel sorry for people who say that. I really do. You are depriving yourself of one of life's greatest joys. Because why not? Why do you stop drinking? Why do you switch to coffee? You could keep drinking and get something ultimately really delicious. And you could even sub out, like maybe you say no to the chocolate cake and say yes to a port or a sauterne or something like that. Like I they're magical.
Yeah. Make a couple within reason, a couple recommendations on if somebody wants to say, forget dessert. I heard Daniela, sounds cool. I want to try that, a dessert wine.
Yeah. I'll give a white and a red. How's okay. that?
Yep.
The first white I'll give is one of the most ethereal, best sweet dessert wines in the world. And that's coming from, of course, France. It's called Sauternes. So it's Sauternes. And it's from the Bordeaux region, surprisingly. And it's the greatest. It really tastes like it tastes like orange marmalade and dried pineapple and, you know, a lot of peach. And it's so gorgeous. And you'd either have that separate or you could have it with salty cheese is really delicious. Or you could have it with something like a pineapple upside down cake or a creme brulee. Anything that's not chocolate, I would say.
Okay.
So there's one idea. And then the second one would be for a dessert wine. I mean, you could go port, but there's so much bad port out there. And I think that's what gives port a bad reputation. So my recommendation, always go with something with a vintage on it. Don't go with something unless there's a year on it. Cause some ports are a blend of multiple years.
Yeah.
Go with something that has a year. Awesome. So good. Amazing.
Okay. That's good advice because my experience up until recently was bad port. And then when to some of us, bad port is just really, really bad. I mean, it's like, write it off, forget it, never going there again. I don't know what I'm doing. That was my position. And then I was around people who knew their stuff. And sure enough, it was out of this world. I mean,
Yeah, I mean, I just got married in Portugal because I got married in the place that they made port because I previously discounted that region. It's one of the most gorgeous regions ever, and I tasted the most amazing vintage ports, and my mind is blown by the quality.
Somebody is going, this leads me, I'm not going to talk about marriage, but somebody's, you laugh, so you laughed in my face. Somebody wants to go on a trip for wine, or they want to go on a trip and it's sort of off the beaten path where they could go, where they probably don't expect that they could find great wines. What would that be? So under the radar. I mean, everybody knows, are you going to go to Napa, blah, blah, blah. But what's in this country, what would be under the radio, under the radar, and then in Europe?
Oh, in this country.
Yeah. What's under the radar?
I think Washington is very much still under the radar, like great, great producers. The problem is kind of getting there.
Yeah.
It's not closer to Seattle. Like the be you have to cross the Cascades and go a few hours east, but worth it. Beautiful, kind of deserty looking. And I think the wines, like if you like Cabernets, Merlots, you're gonna enjoy that a lot.
Okay.
The Willamette is great, but people know about it. That's not under the radar anymore. So I would say that. And then in Europe, as I mentioned, Portugal, I cannot recommend it enough. It's so amazing, and people aren't giving those wines. They don't just make port, they do make dry whites and reds that are very affordable. And then the other one I'll say is Croatia. Croatia is really cool, and more and more people are going to Croatia, and the wines there I think are worth paying attention to too.
Yeah, I've had some. It's hard to, I mean, it's hard to find here, but it really
Yeah.
is pretty fantastic.
Yeah. Exactly.
But isn't that, I mean, somebody traveling from the States to Croatia, that's kind of a European hotbed already, isn't it? I mean, is it going to be less expensive for us?
Yeah, I mean, for yeah, the wines, I mean, you go across to Europe and you're not paying the importer fees, you're not paying the three-tier system that we have. So I can find the same, like the same bottle that goes for $30 here is probably going for 10 euro in Europe. So I think it's a bargain. The wine and food to me feels like a bargain. Yeah, the cost of getting there, that's expensive.
Right.
But then you're in Croatia, you're abroad, and that's the whole point.
Last thing, make some recommendations on openers.
Oh yeah.
Do it. Go ahead. Do it. Make fun of me.
You guys
But I
are
still
all
have.
using the wrong openers, and it drives me crazy.
Okay.
That little arm thing, the one that has the arms.
Yeah.
Please stop using that. That is Satan's tool. It should really be banned.
You know what
It's
else
awful.
happens? This is so amateurish. Does anybody else get cut a lot with their opening wine? Those
Why
little,
do?
the
I mean,
little,
I do on the floor.
yeah, the foil slices your fingers up. I mean, this is how you know you're dealing with a person who is either drinking too much. Or, no, this is a person drinking too much. They have those sliced things on their fingers, or maybe that's just me.
No, it's not just you. Like I open probably five or six, but I probably open 12 bottles of wine a week. And you know when you're dating somebody in the wine
Too.
industry, or whether you're talking to someone in the wine industry with like they have like little cuts. Like they
Yeah,
look like a
right.
cutter on their fingers. Yeah. No, the foil
It's really
is a
pathetic when someone's not in the wine industry and they have all the cuts. I mean, that's not a good sign.
problem.
That's a little terrifying.
You gotta look at. Then you know
Oof.
they just drink a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah,
Right? I
I
mean,
think yeah. I mean,
it's nobody wants to admit it, but it's a thing, it's a
no.
problem.
Oh, it's definitely a problem. Foil cutters, like really sharp ones, those are great. And I don't have a foil cutter. I should probably get one. But yeah, that little tool. Nobody wants to use two tools to open up their wine,
Yeah.
which is. It makes sense, but that little arm thing you got to get rid of. The only thing that I use in my house is a waiter's corkscrew, and it's a double hinged waiter's corkscrew. It is this, it's like the length of your hand or a little bit less, definitely less. and it has a foil cutter on it. It has a little knife. You slice the foil off and you open it like an, and it's very compact. You stick it in your pocket. Anything else, I hesitate to recommend.
Well, wait, so you use that old school thing where you jab it in there and then start twisting? That's, you're going to tell us that's better than the arms?
Well, that thing is the arms, isn't it? That thing that you jab in and then you hinge up. Don't use that. I don't even know how to use that effectively.
I see people do it, but.
So that thing belongs in like a museum. That's so old school. I'd rather you use like one of those rabbit corkscrews, which I actually just got one as a present. And I secretly like them, is those things you zzz, and
yeah,
then you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. What's up with those?
I kind of like that. They're kind of fun. I'll stop being snobby for a second and really, I admit that I do like a good
rabbit.
Okay.
So that's the thing. Now you can see this in some wine bars. They have it off in the corner usually. That's the thing. You just stick it up there zzz, and it's all done. Right.
Yeah. Like you press the button down, it mechanically puts the corkscrew in, and then you press the button up and it brings it back out.
Right.
Yeah.
You recommend that?
Yeah. I like it. Yeah.
Why are you laughing at? Like it's some kind of slimy thing that the rest of us are doing.
I think that like the rest of us aren't here doing it, especially if you're in the wine industry. If you bring one of those out, like that thing's hefty and it's big. It's not going to fit in places. So we don't use those because out in public, like they're not very efficient.
Yeah.
But in your own home, I think they're great as long as you don't have a really old bottle, because the old corks can sometimes disintegrate and that might not be the best choice for
that. Okay. So at home, you want to have one of those. What do those go for?
You know, I think they're like $40. They're okay. Not too bad.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Any other suggestions?
So many, but you know, we don't have all day. I think.
Could you trick me into drinking Chardonnay and having me like it?
Probably.
Okay.
But you would know what I was doing, so I'm going to probably have to do a sneak back on you.
What does that mean? Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I'm going to have to bombard. Like one day I'm going to be like, okay, I'm bringing in these wines, and then I'm not going to tell you what they are. But I mean, you're going to just have to forget our conversation.
What is the time of day when you first have a glass of wine?
Personally?
Yeah.
It depends. I mean, during the weekends, it's getting later and later now that I'm getting older, but I used to start at 11, I think, for a good brunch. It's a good time.
Okay.
Now it's probably 2 or 3 on the weekends.
Yeah.
I might add.
Is it a bad sign if someone who's not in the wine industry is starting at 3 o'clock?
No, I mean, it's fun. And then I'm also like, some of our seminars start at 10 a.m. Yeah. So I have to be like, sometimes I'm drinking wine all day long. It's great.
Okay. So last thing, tell people how they can follow you or anything else you want to put out there. So they can attend.
So,
I've attended, I believe, 2 of your classes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a little private level 2 class. So I am at, on Instagram at Daniela. That is Daniela with 1 L, Masters Wine. You can find me at DanielaDeSouda@gmail.com. If you're wanting to reach out about any classes, if you want me to come to your home, I do private events, or if you need some wine by something in nature. And yeah, I think that's all I want to give them.
Yeah. I would cut you off if you gave them more. Okay. Just
here's my personal
self. I'm just looking out for you. That's all. All right. It's always good seeing you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jeff. I appreciate you.
You bet. Bye. Wherever you are on the hot sauce scale, Could be hot, mild, somewhere in between. All natural ATX hot sauces has something for you. And I need to add award-winning to the ATX hot sauce resume because ATX hot sauce took home 2 gold medals at the famous Austin Chronicle Hot Sauce Awards. This is a 32-year-old event that brings out the biggest and the best in the hot sauce space. And it was the very first time ATX hot sauce had even entered the event. Cool name, cool logo, and very cool slogan. Flavor first, heat second, and instead of saying local all the way, I'll add going national all the way. Order now. Go to atxhotsauce.com. That's atxhotsauce.com.
Get the Jeff Ward Show podcast on the Apple or Spotify podcast platform or wherever you're listening right now.